thanks for coming along tonight, where Bella de Brera makes her inaugural appearance at the Sydney Institute, I think, although she's been in the audience on quite a few occasions. Now, she's well known to some of you. She's currently the director of the Foundation for Western Civilization at the Institute of Public Affairs, based in Melbourne, but you work out of Sydney.
That's great.
And, of course, she's an author. She's done a PhD and many other things besides. So well qualified to talk tonight on Australia's campus history crisis in person. Bella de Brera, thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Gerard and Anne, for inviting me tonight. I feel privileged and honoured to be here, and I hope that my talk in some way contributes to the debate and discussion in Sydney. Now, the title of the talk is about a crisis at Australian universities, in particular, a historical crisis. Now, I'm sure many of you are aware that there are many crises at Australian universities, and most of them are entirely of their own making, including the one that I want to talk about tonight. The problem that I'm talking about is how history is being taught in our university departments, or rather, the subjects that are being offered to undergraduates as history in our university departments. They're two very different things. I'm also going to talk to you about the far-reaching and profound repercussions that all this is having on our culture, on our society, and on our nation. But let's start with the nitty-gritty. Let's start with what they're actually teaching to students in 2023 in the history departments of our universities. But I'm going to go back to 2015 first, actually, which is some research that the IPA did before I joined in 2015. And some researchers looked at every subject that was being taught in history across the universities at the time, and they concluded that history in universities was dying. 7 years on, I propose to you that history is no longer dying, it's well and truly dead. This is because history in Australian universities has been completely subsumed by postmodernist, critical race theory, gender theory, post-colonial theory, queer theory. Whatever theory you can dream up, it's in the history department. And it's pretending to be history. My report was entitled Forgetting the Past, How Postmodernist Theory Has Replaced Australian History in 2022. And like my predecessors, I looked at 791 subjects currently taught across 35 universities. And to recap, I found that there were more subjects which covered race than democracy, 86 compared to 33. More which looked at identity over the Enlightenment, 64 subjects on identity and only 25 on Enlightenment, and far more which were concerned with sexuality, 54, than the Reformation, 17. Overall, the top three themes being discussed by historians in history departments at the moment are gender, Indigenous issues, and race. It's clear, these academics are far more preoccupied with an approach grounded in postmodernist theory with an emphasis on race, gender, sexuality, than key historical moments of Western civilization, such as the Reformation, the Renaissance, the Scientific Revolution, or the Enlightenment. Their version of history being taught to undergraduates has become solely a history of supposed Western sins. And one sin which is of growing concern to historians appears to be whiteness, or white privilege, which of course is couched in the language of critical race theory, which has been imported straight from America. I'll give you an example of one of the subjects taught at Flinders University. It's called Indigenous Women's Voices, Race, Gender, and Colonialism. In this unit, students spend their time learning, quote, a history of colonialism as its starting point, and they investigate how ideas about and practices of race interwoven with gender shape the lives of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. Later in the course, they introduce the idea of whiteness as a racial category and raises questions about the relationship of non-Indigenous feminist theory and practice to the lives of Indigenous women in Australia. Not to be outdone, the University of Melbourne offers Race in the Americas, which will consider the experience of people of Asian descent living in Western Hemisphere, the history of whiteness in a variety of American nations, including the history of the procession of immigrant groups seeking assimilation into the category of white, as well as more recent turns toward racial extremism. This is the stuff they're getting in history departments. Another of these sins preoccupying historians is, of course, gender inequality, and thus we see radical gender theory dominating history. Gender theory, I'm sure you all know, is generally considered to be a form of postmodernist feminist scholarship, which contends that categories of male and female are oppressive stereotypes, and that gender is both culturally and sociologically constructed. Gender theory makes gender, rather than biological sex, central. It treats gender and sexuality as social constructs, and it reads power into those constructions, and it focuses on identity. This is so entrenched in our universities that the University of Melbourne even offers a gender history pathway as part of a Bachelor of Arts in History. Students will study gender, rights, and leadership in history, which introduces key issues in the history of sex, gender, power, and identity. In other universities, you can take Gendered Worlds, Introduction to Gender Studies at the University of New South Wales, Histories of Sexuality, Gender, Power, Pleasures, and the Body at La Trobe University, and Sex, Sin, and Heresy in Early Medieval Europe at the University of New England. At least you probably get something to do with the Middle Ages there, but probably for one class, and then the rest of it will be gender. I'm not exaggerating. You can go to the websites of all these universities, look at their courses, and click on the pathways, and you'll see how much there is. This is not hyperbole, unfortunately. And the tragedy of this, of course, is that any student who hasn't learned any history at school, which is a distinct possibility these days, will not be able to grow their historical understanding of Western civilization or Australia or even humanity at university. They'll probably be able to recite Judith Butler's Gender Trouble, but they won't be able to tell you anything about the history of Western civilization. In this way, history as a discipline in our universities is in deep crisis. And on that point, I do think Australian universities need to start being honest with undergraduates before they commence their degrees. Those subjects which are by and large dominated by critical race theory and gender theory and queer theory, but that are currently being sold as history, should be moved to a more suitable home. They should be in sociology or gender studies where they belong. In The Idea of History, the great English philosopher, historian R.G. Collingwood wrote, "History is for human self-knowledge. The only clue to what man can do is what man has done. The value of history, then, is that it teaches us what man has done and thus what man is." On that basis alone, I doubt that Collingwood would recognise what's being taught as history, and he'd certainly agree that it's of little value, because crackpot postmodernist theory doesn't teach us what we have done and thus what we are. And of course, one of the problems with postmodernism is that when it comes to the past, it posits that nothing can actually be learnt from the past. It says historians just need to give up their claim to any special authority in the matter, and they should just approach the field as a way of critical self-reflection. In other words, postmodernism rejects the notion that the past can be understood historically. Yet, despite this, these postmodernist historians are doing their best to show that historically, Western civilization has been structurally, institutionally, morally, and epistemically violent in its entirety. Any critique of this approach, however, goes down very badly indeed with many in the academic community. We know this of what happened to Professor James H. Sweet last year, who happens to be the president of the American Historical Association. He noted a massive decline in undergraduates studying history. So he wrote an article for the AHA's journal, and dared to suggest that perhaps some of the onus lay on the historians themselves. In his article entitled, "Is History History? Identity Politics and Teleologies of the Present," Sweet suggested, ever so gently, that maybe, just maybe, historians might like to refocus their attention on the past and move away from critical race theory and radical gender theory. He wrote, "If we don't read the past through the prism of contemporary social justice issues, race, gender, sexuality, nationalism, capitalism, are we doing history that matters? This new history often ignores the values and mores of people in their own times, as well as change over time. neutralising the expertise that separates historians from all those other disciplines. After he published the article, he was called a racist, and he broke the number one rule for dissenters. He apologised. Never apologise to the mob. We all know that an apology is never enough to appease the woke gods. Poor old Sweet. But anyway, he still got his job. But the important points here are Sweet's fellow historians believe there is only one acceptable worldview. Two, it's racist to not look at the world through a contemporary lens. And historians believe that they're actually doing history that matters. The history that they're doing is history with a political purpose. Of course, harnessing history to politics is not without precedent. We've seen it before many times in history. We saw it in the 18th century with historian and MP Edward Gibbon, who very provocatively argued at the time that Christianity had hastened the fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbon, of course, was a product of the Age of Enlightenment, which emphasized reason over superstition, and he was extremely heavily influenced by the anti-Christian, or rather anti-Catholic, French philosophe, who believed that the development of human reason would unleash advances in every human endeavor, and that organized religion was an impediment to progress. The other, of course, was Thomas Babington Macaulay, the 19th century historian and liberal politician who possessed an unshakable belief in the idea of human progress. Macaulay created a national story in which superstition and autocracy was overcome by the Glorious Revolution in 1688, after which Britain adopted a balanced constitution and a culture of freedom of belief and expression. As it so happens, Macaulay's version of history, which is the Whig version of history, was a very powerful tool for the emerging Liberal Party, and the Whiggish history became the national story. In 1931, Herbert Butterfield, in his Whig interpretation of history, didn't actually attack Macaulay personally, but he did seek to show how history is distorted when historians impose their prejudices on the study of the past, and that they should endeavour, quote, to evoke a certain sensibility towards the past, the sensibility which studies the past for the sake of the past. Both Gibbon and Macaulay had political projects. Both absolutely reflected the prejudice of their ages, and both definitely had a moral superiority over previous generations. And I think the same could be said for historians in academia today, many of whom certainly reflect the prejudice of our age, which I suppose would be called the woke prejudice, and who display an unshakable belief in their own moral superiority. What they've done is that they've reinvented themselves as social justice warriors with a clearly defined political program, which is to critique the history of Western civilization in order to justify pulling it down and starting again in a sort of year zero way. I think we've heard this before somewhere in history. This political program, of course, is not just limited to our history departments. Once bastions of debate and freedom of opinion, our universities are now warehouses for the production of people with exactly the same view. The humanities departments are just chock full of activists whose careers revolve around dismantling Western civilization. You may remember here a few years ago when the Ramsey Center for Western Civilization tried to establish a great books course. It encountered an incredible amount of hostility, especially here at the University of Sydney, where the academics and students banded together and with a big sign saying, you know, Ramsey, to keep Ramsey out of University of Sydney, this is going to be white supremacy writ large, this is racism, it's going to be disastrous, don't take Shakespeare on campus. And of course, this is absolute nonsense. There are three universities now running a great books course on Western civilization, and there has not been an increase in white supremacy or racially motivated attacks because more people are reading the Odyssey. But with those three exceptions, most English departments, or what is left of them, I understand that they're not what they used to be, are trying to rid their curricula of dead white men, not add to them. Universities around the West, not just in Australia, of course, in the UK and New Zealand and Canada and America, they're all decolonizing themselves according to the edicts of post-colonial theory. And unfortunately, because what happens in the university doesn't stay in the university, we're now seeing this decolonization movement do its best to decolonize our entire culture. Practitioners of decolonization want to remove all symbols and legacies of our past, which they consider to be irredeemably tainted by colonialism. Museums and libraries now believe that their role in society is to subject to critique everything that they're supposed to value. once tasked with storing the knowledge accumulated through centuries of discovery. They're now looking at their own connections, trying to work out what's been stolen and who to send it back to. In London, the British Museum's currently in discussion with the Nigerian government about returning its collection of Benin bronzes. Some of you might be aware of this is happening. Germany's got some bronzes, they've already sent them back. But as it turns out, there's some people in America, descendants of the people captured and sold into slavery by the Benin Kingdom, who don't want the treasures to go back to Nigeria. They want those treasures to stay in the Western museums where they're accessible to all. This is how complicated this all gets. Meanwhile, of course, academics in the University of Manchester and Oxford are demanding that the Rosetta Stone, which is the British Museum's most visited object, be returned to Egypt, even though arguably it's not originally Egyptian. I hope it stays there, but I have my doubts given who is currently the director of the British Museum, Hartwig Fischer, who in 2017 said that he was going to make the museum less Eurocentric and that it was time to move away from telling the story of world cultures through this pesky European point of view. Following the death of George Floyd, he even waxed lyrical about how the museum is aligned in spirit and soul to the Black Lives Matter movement, promising to reevaluate the collections in the name of inequality and discrimination. Australia comes into this actually because he made sure that the items in an exhibition called Reimagining Captain Cook, Pacific Perspectives, were relabeled to reflect the false narrative that Captain James Cook was responsible for the invasion and occupation of Australia. Meanwhile, in Bloomsbury, over at the British Library, the chief librarian declared a racial state of emergency. This is the librarian, and she formed a decolonizing working group to purge the library of perceived racist books, not just books, but all the manuscripts, all the classical music, anything by Mozart, anything by Beethoven, it all has to go. In fact, they were talking about how they were going to get rid of the a painting of Punch and Judy fame because there was too much sort of male toxicity and white privilege. I hope that the painting's still there. So the decolonizers are working away in our museums and libraries. They're also on the streets, as we know, in the last few years. We've seen mobs out in force pulling down whatever statue they can find. As long as it's something to do with colonialism, he can be pro-slavery, anti-slavery, he can be a Confederate, he can be not a Confederate. But, you know, they're going about whipping themselves up into this frenzied state of blind fury and persecuting stone and metal for the real and imagined sins of those people depicted. Actually, during the BLM sort of movement here in Sydney a couple of years ago, the statue of Captain Cook in Hyde Park even had to have its own police protection, I think, for about 12 or 24 hours because he was going to be vandalised by the protesters. And the important point here, I think, about pulling down statues is that it's not just their expression of a sort of moral revulsion at the supposed racism of our ancestors and our forebears, but it's also tactical because by tearing down or vandalizing statues, that mob is declaring ownership on the present because it's taken control of the past through either defacing the statue or erasing it or tossing it into a river. And this is the nub of the problem. This movement is erasing the past, not just the bad bits, but the good bits too. This means that future generations, of course, will have no idea about the ideas that have worked and the great successes of Western civilization and what makes Australia a successful nation today, things that were a good idea, to put it very simply. Equally, they won't know about the mistakes of our forebears and will be doomed to making the same blunders over and over again. We and our leaders need to be able to recognise the signs of totalitarianism. We need to be able to recognise threats to our freedoms and to our personal, very precious personal sovereignty. And of course, the only way of doing this is to cast our minds and our eyes backwards. Had more Australians been taught about the communist regimes of the 20th century, would they have willingly handed over their freedoms to the government during the last couple of years? Would they have objected in greater numbers to the authoritarianism which raised its ugly head under the auspices of keeping us safe? Perhaps the thousands of Victorians who eagerly rang the police hotline to report their neighbours for going out more than the allocated hour, or for not wearing a mask outside, or maybe for breaking the curfew, might have thought twice had they been taught about the Stasi at school or university. Who knows? So just to recap, The crisis in our history departments, which are now dominated by postmodernist theory, is clearly not confined to the history departments, but it's also infected the humanities. And it's been infecting our cultural institutions, our educational institutions, and our political institutions. There's now one acceptable narrative, which is that Western civilization is evil and racist, and of course that means the modern state of Australia is also evil and racist. To suggest otherwise is now evil and racist. This narrative, this distortion of history, I believe, is creating a national crisis. There's no doubt that Australian society is much less confident and much more fractured than it was 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. Australians are constantly told at every opportunity that the modern state of Australia was not just a terrible mistake, but a crime which needs to be endlessly deplored and apologised for. No matter how mundane the activity, the sense that non-Aboriginal Australians should feel guilty is now drummed into us on a daily basis, whether it's on a plane, whether it's looking at an art gallery's website, whether it's catching the Sky bus, as I discovered the other day, from Melbourne City to Tullamarine. I was shouted at and told that sovereignty had never been ceded before I heard about the rules of the Sky bus and how I was going to get to my aeroplane on time. Every year, voices calling for Australia Day to be cancelled and replaced with Invasion Day are growing louder and much more insistent. And of course, this is having an effect. The majority of Australians are becoming more and more reluctant to celebrate Australia Day. They don't want to fly the flag. They don't want to loudly say that they're proud of the country because it's becoming very impolitically correct. And of course, this is aided and abetted by people such as Lydia Thorpe, who's been in the news a lot in the last couple of days, who appears to all accounts to despise this country. Her rhetoric is completely unrelated to the reality of how the modern state of Australia was founded by the British. And her entire campaign is predicated on a rewriting of history, which is entirely for political purposes. She's part of a movement which sees the goal of treaty as unfinished business of colonization, and its principal aim is to restore Aboriginal governance or sovereignty. Last week, of course, Penny Wong, our foreign minister, who wouldn't be foreign minister had it not been for the values and institutions of Western civilization, flew all the way to London to lecture the British about how bad the empire was and the horrors of colonialism. And her speech did sound a lot like an undergraduate's essay on post-colonial theory. And of course, Albanese has said that he wants fair dinkum history to be taught in schools. He doesn't believe, his fair dinkum and our fair dinkum are very, very unlike each other. By fair dinkum, he means that children need to be taught about the atrocities committed by people of British descent upon Aboriginal Australians. Of course, we're in the middle of the Albanese government committing to dividing Australians by race, by way of creating a parallel system of representative government comprised of Aboriginal Australians to the exclusion of all other Australians. Albanese and the left-wing political parties promote fake history by the way of education to continue to inflict guilt and shame on the nation until such a time that their ideas are accepted as fait accompli. Speaking of education, the single narrative currently taught to Australian children in the national curriculum is that Australia was founded on racism and that the arrival of the First Fleet in 1788 resulted in dispossession and genocide. Not only are they being taught that this is a history of unbroken violence and exploitation, but then until now, this story has been whitewashed by pro-Western apologists. You teach this to children for long enough and they'll end up believing it. A poll commissioned by the IPA last year in the light of the Russian invasion of Ukraine revealed that the majority of 18 to 24-year-olds would not be prepared to stay and fight if the country were to be invaded. They would flee. These are the ones we need to stay and fight, not the ones disappearing. In another poll, the IPA commissioned about Australia Day, only 42% of 18 to 24-year-olds agreed that Australia Day should be celebrated on the 26th of January. 30% disagreed, and 28% had no opinion. You can hardly blame young Australians for having such a negative view of their history, given the abuse of history that's taking place in schools and universities. As a society, of course, we need to confront past injustices and not dismiss them. But focusing solely on the dark pages does not benefit society in the long run. We need to talk about how Australia is a direct beneficiary of the fruits of Western civilization, which include, of course, the foundations of our political system, our governmental, and our administrative offices, freedoms, democratic institutions, and our cultural heritage. Manning Clark wrote, "History, to be great as history, must have a point of view on the direction of society. It must also have something to say, some great theme to lighten our darkness." Yesterday, in response to Penny Wong, I saw that Alexander Downer had written an article for The Telegraph in the UK, and he said, "Not unreasonably, most Australians are very proud of their country and its many achievements. Of course, it's made mistakes, and sometimes people have been cruel to each other. In that sense, Australia is no different from anywhere else. But on the whole, it's a more successful society in terms of both harmony and prosperity than almost any other society on earth." He continued, "The far left may not place much value on this, but most Australians do. Migrants from other parts of the world have rushed to get to Australia because of the success of this country, not because they abhor British colonialism and its legacy." Imagine how different the national conversation would be if the activists in the media, in public spaces, in museums, in universities, in schools, civil service, local government, businesses and corporations stopped pushing this single narrative of critique on Australian society. This movement to rewrite history is undermining Australia's self-confidence, dividing communities and deepening resentments, and in some cases, casting doubt on whether it should even exist at all. It's time to reclaim our history and stop this corrosive movement in its tracks. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Bella. And coming to questions and discussion, I just remind people not to stand in front of the microphone. In front of the camera down the end. And keep your comments or questions as brief as possible. Just coming back to you, to your talk, I think I heard you discussing, it occurred to me that what you were talking about with gender, Indigenous issues and race has been the agenda of history departments. It's also very much the agenda of the ABC. I mean, it's almost identical. But I recall you saying on Sky News, somewhere I saw you over Christmas, you made the point there that there is a lot of good history being written in Australia. A lot of it's been written by journalists. Some has been written by former academics. It's not coming out of history departments, but it's still prevalent. And I'm reminded that Mark Carlton, who's a raving lefty, but he's written some very good books on the First World War and naval history in Australia. So some of these journalists do quite well, but obviously it must appear to be the culture of the history departments, like it is the culture of the ABC, that leads to the kind of problem you're addressing.
Yes, I was actually going to make that point, but I ran out of time. It's the discipline of history is dead, but history itself is very much alive and thriving. The airports and bookshops are always full of history books that are just fascinating, and I think it's one of the most popular genres anywhere. And I don't know if you've listened to the podcast The Rest Is History, which is just one of the most downloaded podcasts around at the moment. And it's just two historians talking about history without any of this class, race and gender. So the question is, you know, what do you do with the history departments? Because history is actually fine outside the history department. It's surviving perfectly well outside academia. So perhaps the history departments, as I said earlier, just need to be honest, and they need to stop calling themselves historians and move into the sociology department or the gender department, and just do away with history departments altogether.
Can we go to Dimitri, then I'll take one from the Zoom.
Hi, Bella. Thanks for your presentation. Before I get my question, just a quick one in case there's any ABC journalists here. This is not a white supremacist meeting. It seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the most virulent strain of this virus that you describe is in the English-speaking world of nations descended from England, and countries that are perhaps the most receptive to immigrants. Am I correct? And if so, why is that so?
That is a very good question. I often wonder that myself, and I don't have the... I know it's exclusive. It's as you say, it's particularly virulent in the Anglosphere countries. In the US is probably worse than Australia, but we're getting there. The UK has its own problems with... I mean, obviously, the US has the 1619 project, which is undermining the entire country. And England is battling this whole slavery question and the British Empire. And we've got our own... undoing Australia problem of post-colonialism. Canada I'm not so familiar with, but I'm sure it's got similar things going on. I don't know about the European countries, and it's an interesting question because, you know, in the grand scheme of colonialism, the Portuguese and the French and the Belgians were terrible. So if you're going to have a movement that sort of wants to decolonize or at least... come to terms with the past in terms of colonization. I mean, go to Belgium. It's odd to me that there is so much focus on these countries when the good obviously outweighs the bad, and obviously the British Empire put a stop to slavery. This is something that is highly unpopular to be. It's a historical fact, but they don't want to hear it. I actually just saw, I was watching Calvin Robinson address the Oxford Union about this, about reparations, and he actually said that. He said, you know, the British Empire actually put a stop to slavery, and he was booed and jeered by the students for actually just a bland historical fact. So I can't tell you why it's not happening in France and Italy, and I don't speak French or Italian well enough, and the academia is quite, you know, it's a very different world. I can't read their journals and things, so it doesn't seem to be as bad.
I've got a Zoom question here from someone who's described as a former ancient historian. I think he's not that ancient, and I think he's not that former either, at any rate. Now, have the trends you've been talking about spread from modern history departments to ancient history and classics departments?
It's from what I gather, it's not as bad in the classics. It's very hard to put identity politics into learning ancient Greek when there's a language, when it's learning a language, and it's actually for some reason, again, there's a, when you look at the how the history departments are have arranged their courses, there's a lot of ancient history and it seems okay, and then there's a massive gap, and then it's all 20th century. And it's all identity politics. So again, for some reason, the classics seem to be okay. Although I think in Cambridge recently they decided that they wanted to do away with the sculptures of the ancient Greeks, the plaster casts that they have there on the campus, because they were too much too European, too white, too white centric. So I'm sure they'll come for the classics. I mean, they're coming for STEM, so.
No, we're going in order. Richard.
Thank you. That was such a true representation of history of the last 20 years you've given us. I get down to the question of why, and I'd like you to go to Antonio Gramsci. And as you well know, he was an Italian philosopher, died in jail with Mussolini. He was a communist, and he saw, along with his successor, Rudolf Deutsch, that the great march Mouse through the institutions was the way to achieve socialism, which, as Karl Marx said, was just the junior of communism. Is that what we are suffering, the consequences of that philosophy in this very, very wealthy world we live in today in the West?
Short answer, yes. So yes, I didn't want to mention the march through institutions because we've been talking about the march through the institutions for as long as it's been happening, and it's happened. This postmodernism is, you know, as soon as you start talking about postmodernism and things like postcolonial theory and critical race theory, they're really hard to define, and they're hard to define on purpose. But ultimately, what I see happening is that the Marxist idea of the bourgeois oppressing the poor has been enlarged, so it's now, you know, to encompass race and to gender. Everyone is oppressed by the white patriarchy, and the reason why, so going back a bit, the The historians are looking at the world like we are and saying, well, it's a fallen world. There's inequality, there's poverty. Some people are richer than others. Something's not quite right. Our solution is to pull down what we have and put something else in place, whether it's socialism, whether it's communism, whether it's something else altogether, but they never have that solution in place. All I can see is that it's been a deliberate distortion and abuse of history using a sort of postmodernist Marxist lens to get society into a place where the institutions and the values are so degraded and so and we're so divided that the world is ready for something else. And I think in a way it's a utopian movement.
Come in here.
Thanks for your talk, wonderful. The comment I wanted to make was the University of Sydney has lost its Hebrew studies, gone to Catholic University.
You said Hebrew studies?
Yeah.
Okay.
Something as basic as that, it can no longer exist at the university I go into 3 days a week. I'm always pestered by training modules.
Right.
And I refused to do any of them, and I fought them about them, and eventually they tipped me off.
Did they?
Otherwise, I would lose access to the literature of the university.
Well, that's what they're doing at Monash as well. They have to do an Indigenous course.
So I can just confirm how bad it's got.
It is bad. You have to do an Indigenous course at Monash, otherwise they won't let you get your degree. So that's freedom of speech for you.
If I could just go back to 1912... How did modern historians regard Captain Smith, who was British, saying women and children first? And the headline of the day would have been Iceberg since Titanic. Now they would say Titanic, victim of climate change.
Yes, they would. Yeah, I haven't even got into the climate change material in the history departments because it's I didn't have time, but obviously that is a big thing in. Well, it's actually a big thing in school. They teach more climate change than they do history.
Well, I'll go further than your comment about virus. I'll say poison. And the students in our university are going to go out into all areas of our social life, the whole of the country. And seeing this is so, this poison is so entrenched now in our universities, amongst many other areas, but in our universities, what's to be done?
Well, we have to start thinking about starting our own schools. If you want to sort of deal with the problem at a school level, we've got to scrap the national curriculum. But that's never going to be done because it's once something like that is in place, no government is ever going to get rid of it. There's too many bureaucrats running the place, and it's having too good a result in if you're on that side of things. If you're a left wing bureaucrat, you need the national curriculum. In terms of universities, start another university. That's what's happening in America. Unfortunately, it's almost impossible here because the government doesn't want dissenters to start an organization in which another point of view might be taught. So if you have university aged children, I'd be sending them overseas or to Campion in New South Wales here, which is the only other option.
But hang on a second, that's impossible. People don't have the money to do
no,
that.
No, that's
and Campion right. Campion College does very good work, but it's only got a limited number of students, so that can't work. But also Liberal governments didn't want to open up new universities either, did they?
No government does.
Because it costs a lot of money.
So what do you do? Do you try your level best to start an alternative institution, or do you send your... first of all, you'll dissuade your son or daughter from doing history or any humanities subjects. I think that's the most sensible approach. And just get them to read the history books and listen to podcasts and do a degree which is hopefully still relatively free of identity politics and postmodernism.
Push it down here.
I won't eat. Do you see paradoxically an acceleration of this bad trend in universities resulting from the end of the Cold War and the totalitarian challenges of the 20th century? Is there perhaps a hope that the renewed totalitarian challenge from China and, of course, the invasion of Ukraine from Russia might offer some hope for a reversal and a resharpening of a clear definition of what it is like and what it is necessary for a free society?
I think there are a lot of people outside academia who will see these things very clearly, but I have my doubts about a lot of the people who are so entrenched in this worldview that no matter what happens, they will stay true to this this anti-Western civilization, very, very narrow focus that they sort of seem to be trapped in.
Up the back.
Thanks very much for your talk tonight. It's terrific. I think what you're addressing is a change in beliefs. And if you look at Western civilization, it's come from a Judeo-Christian belief system. And what we're confronting is the abandonment of Christian Judeo values right across the Western world. And if you're trying to address the embrace of this alternative worldview, you have to go back and say, well, how do we bring Christianity and Christian Judeo values and make them acceptable and embraced in the way that perhaps our generation grew up with them and absorbed them, just in the way our families operated, in the way our communities operated, and the way our governments behaved. I'm just, trying to dig into the idea that it's all about belief systems. And if you're talking about the development and the success of the Western model, it was because of deeply rooted belief in God and there being right and wrong.
Okay.
So I'll be interested in your comments.
I think, look, everyone in this room accepts that's true, because we're over 40, most of us in this room. The problem is that, and I keep going back to schooling because it happens way before university, is that they do have a belief system being taught to them, but that belief system is mishmash of Gaia worship, globalism, paganism, sort of worshipping the earth, but with a strange amount of Malthusianism in there as well, and sustainability. So they hear nothing about Christian values. They probably do at Christian schools, but your average Australian who goes to a government school will hear nothing about it at all. And if they're not learning it at home, they're not learning it at school, they'll go through their entire lives with absolutely no idea. And this is the big challenge, and this is why we need to scrap the national curriculum and give the responsibility back to parents and back to teachers who actually want to teach this kind of material, because they can't at the moment. It's not in the national curriculum, and they don't have time. They're completely overworked trying to teach about indigenous issues and sustainability. So it is a very deep problem in not just Australian society, but in all of the Anglosphere countries. It's the same thing. It's the replacement of Christianity with something else, and that something else is a very strange combination of sort of Saint Greta and everything else.
Bella, wonderful speech. We just need another 25 or 7 of you. I think the best thing I heard tonight was you saying that history departments were losing students. I think that'd be excellent. I think if they all left and nobody turned up for history, that would be the beginning of the next phase. And I feel sorry for that academic, but he was dead right. I think you would have read it, but everyone should read Douglas Murray's War on the West. But it's in the last chapter where he comes to what the pushback is. And remembering, I'm old enough to remember the 70s very clearly as an adult, and we had a similar kind of moment there where the universities were so left-wing that all these think tanks exploded in Washington and even in Australia. There will be a pushback, and what I want you to give us some idea about is where you see it coming from and how it's going to take place.
There is absolutely a pushback coming, and it's very exciting. There's Jordan Peterson has just announced that he is starting in America. He's starting a sort of online replacement for a Bachelor of Arts that students can do for $4,000 as opposed to $300,000, and they'll get a genuine degree and some knowledge. There is so much now on the internet that is a balm to all this, that we're having conversations now. People are having conversations on podcasts that I would never have imagined 5 or 10 years ago. It is quite remarkable. So you don't have to go very far to find an alternative. And I think it should be parents taking their children from a very early age and making sure that they're not being indoctrinated at school and showing them that there's actually much more interesting history out there, and the truth is out there. So John Peterson again, and he's starting an organization that is going to be pushing back against this worldview that is this sort of globalist worldview that is being taught in universities and is being unleashed in our cultural institutions. So there is a fight back, and it's really exciting. So things have to get very bad, and then people have their backs against the wall, and I think that's what's happening now.
Let's speak into it.
Thank you. In fact, the previous question rather sort of preempted what I was going to say, which is that what you were presenting, I think, is almost like a council of despair, that it's bad out there and there's kind of no hope. One of the advantages of getting a bit older is that you do see things in cycles. Mm. So worth remembering, in the 1730s in Britain, Christianity was finished. I mean, there was no Christianity, no God in England in the 1730s, but 100 years later, there was a huge revival. And it seems to me that at some point, this emphasis on white guilt is going to get a pushback. I mean, the willingness to say sorry and to apologize and to feel guilty is not infinite. And that seems to be the assumption of a number of prominent people in Australia, that you can just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and you'll always make progress. And I just wonder if the decision today by the Prime Minister that in fact they will issue yes and no statements for the referendum this afternoon is not a straw in the wind, which says that actually you can't push people too far.
I think you're right. I think people have a breaking point, and I think if we have another, what is it, 9 months of this kind of discussion about The Voice, I think people will be very, very tired of it by the time it comes to the referendum. And they'll either vote to get rid of it or vote against it. I don't know. But you're right. As I said, we're getting to a point where our back's against the wall, and I think people will naturally fight back. And we're already seeing signs of it, because it is so extreme and it is so bad that we are at a point now where we have to fight to save our culture and our civilization, and people are.
Just going back, following on from the last couple of points, you made a reference to Manny Clark, and you quoted him favourably, I think. But Manny Clark was the leader of the left-wing interpretation of Australian history in Australia. Now, he didn't cover all the issues. What was different between Manny and what Clark and what you're talking about in history departments now is that Manny Clark had different people in his department. He didn't do what the ABC is increasingly doing, what history departments are doing, cancelling people. So he was pluralist in his staff appointments. But if you read his history, I mean, the Conservatives were the forces of dark, which he actually said, and the left was the forces of progress. So really the point was not so much the history, that the lack of any kind of diverse view within the history. But Clark himself, I mean, this what you're talking about is accentuated, but as Alan was suggesting, it's not new. Those of us who went through universities in the 60s and the 70s remember that well. It's just much more intense now and much more vicious as far as censorship goes, but it's not dramatically worse.
Well, I think the ABC is. But going off on from that on the ABC, I think the ABC is losing its audience. It's like the history faculties. They're losing their students. And this happens because increasingly you go around, you're never diminishing circles. So as the ABC lost its Sydney Morning Herald readers, and then it lost its mild liberals, and then it lost some of its hard liberals, you know, people I know just stopped watching. They stopped reading the Sydney Morning Herald. So then they lost them. So then they went harder and harder left. And now they're in trouble all over the place, even with the mayor of Alice Springs. So you do get to a point where you just make yourself unsellable.
There is, take a while. I mean that is obviously a good thing, but my fear is that the politicians have adopted this wholesale, and it doesn't matter what the ABC is saying or not saying, and how many people are watching the ABC who aren't. If they're determined to push this agenda through, it doesn't matter about the ABC or...
That's in terms of the national curriculum.
Well, no, in terms of the voice, in terms of what they're doing to undermining the nation, it doesn't matter if the ABC is talking about it or not. If the politicians have decided, if Albanese has decided that this is the agenda, then he'll push this through. It's the politicians that are the problem.
But the politicians don't make the people vote. I mean, they don't vote the way they're told. But it'll be up to the vote. And if people vote for it, they vote for it.
But we didn't need to have it in the first place.
Well, that's
it's causing divisions in society.
We still have the choice.
He's clearly determined. If he doesn't do it this time, then there'll be another way to divide us.
But just one point on the voice. I mean, there are a lot of conservatives. Consider conservatives who are going to vote yes. I mean, Chris Kenny's not a raving lefty. Some of the legal people I know are not raving lefties. There's not unanimity on this position.
And some lefties are going to vote no.
There's a question up the back. You can respond to that if you wish.
No.
Are you going to oust Chris Kenny as a raving lefty?
Chris Kenny is clearly not a raving lefty.
Bella, thanks for this evening. A lot of the emphasis seems to be on the woke left. I'm worried about the woke right. It does seem that many of the conservative side of politics are as aligned with the woke agenda now as what you were describing earlier. I worry that there isn't the political pushback on the alternative side of politics to take back to a position that would have classical Western values.
Oh, yeah, there's very little difference between attitudes at the moment, between the Labour Party, and this will probably cause problems in this room, but the Liberal Party, I mean, there's...
Could you just speak up a bit?
There's little difference between the Liberal and the Labour parties in terms of the culture. The Liberal Party is terrified of the culture war. We shouldn't be having these battles. They had 8 years to fight these things. They had 8 years to get rid of the national curriculum. By not doing anything, I think they're just as bad as the Labour Party. You wait for someone to come out and say this is wrong. Australia's actually not a racist country. Let's be proud of Australia. Silence. So I agree.
So we're getting close to the end. There's a question here.
Yes, Bella. That's my opinion. Gottliebson had an article in today's, I think, Australian, and he said he's been changing his mind. He was in favour, but now he's worried about his property and how he might have to pay rent for it if we proceed to treaties. And we're all going to lose it.
We're all going to pay rent.
We're really discussing history, not contemporary. The topic is history, not contemporary politics. Okay?
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, it's the same thing in university departments. So.
But it shouldn't be. Now, Dimitri's got I'm losing control of this. Dimitri's...
That's all right.
That's the whole idea.
Is it? Yeah, Dimitri's here. We're getting to the end, yeah.
I hope you don't mind me having another go, Bella. I unfortunately don't share your optimism about the pendulum swinging back. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the comments Neil Ferguson has made. He's also suggested that, there won't be a swing back.
Yeah.
I this is more of a comment than a question, if you want to reply back. All of the pushback is coming from people of our vintage. And if you have a look at a lot of the nonsense that's coming out of universities, US universities, which has metastasized, you can almost draw a line back to the Port Huron statement where they said this is what they're going to do, and they did it. And they were people of a much younger vintage than us. This revolution back, or this pushback, is not coming from the young. It's coming from, for those of us who will soon be dust.
Well, actually, I do disagree with that. Because,
hang on, I just want to make one point. So the Port Huron statement was issued by the Students for a Democratic Society in 1962. Okay, just a bit of background.
Okay. Thank you. We have a part of the IPA is called Generation Liberty. We have a lot of young members, and I deal with them on a weekly basis, and they are outstanding. And they are 20, 21, and they know a lot more than I did at 20 and 21. So they are excellent, excellent young human beings. They're not just you know, your average 21-year-old. And you look at America and you look at something like Daily Wire, Michael Knowles, all those presenters are around 40. They're not super young, but this is the next generation. It's not just people of a certain vintage that are fighting back. Yeah, thank you.
It's going to be very brief.
Yeah. Seeing as you're speaking at the Sydney Institute tonight, we're lucky there's not a great baying mob of students out the whole
day. Yes, I'm glad, actually.
I think they didn't know. So, in the end, just a brief final comment. You're not entirely pessimistic, you're a little bit optimistic.
I'm much more optimistic than I was actually last year. Which is
because, and if we have you back next year,
I'm going to be full of optimism and joy.
But as Anne said, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, that was a very important talk and a lively discussion and a bit of fun as well. And I just want to thank Bella de Bera and wish her good work with the real. I mean, what Bella's doing at the IPA and her foundation is hard empirical grind and work. It's not just opinion, it's opinion based on fact. And we need much, much more of that in Australia and some of the other Western countries. But I'll just finally make a point here. At the Institute here, we hear different views. It wasn't so long ago we had Meredith Bergman here. We've had all sorts of people and all sorts of views here. And it's great to have Bella de Brera here tonight giving her view. And we'll have many other views as the year proceeds. But for tonight, well done and congratulations.